Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, They Had to Go Out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for liking, subscribing, sharing, following, and giving us those 5-star reviews on whatever podcast platform you listen on. If you join us in this crowdcast, we're a little bit early on the start, but if you join us, we appreciate you guys taking the time out of your day and spending some quarantine hours with us. We've got a whole slew of these lined up in the coming weeks. Very special guest for this first one that hopefully we're able to post to YouTube now that we worked out some kinks. So thank you guys for joining us there.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. We're really glad you're here. It's your first time listening to the podcast, joining us on a crowdcast, watching us, however you're consuming us. We really appreciate you being here. After you watch, listen, however you're watching this, go back, listen to some other episodes. You're going to really, I think, really like what you hear. Once you do, follow us on any podcast platform we're available. Also, follow us on social media, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. Go to your search engine, type in They Had to Go Out, and you'll find us there. And then give us those 5-star reviews, give us those likes, and be sure to subscribe.
And now we're going to give you a reason to do all that. So who we've got with us today, Mr. John Ostrowski. He is the president of the Coast Guard Chief Petty Officers Association, which is why we reached out to him, because for those of you who are unaware, 2020 is the centennial year of the creation of the Coast Guard Chief Petty Officer. So before, 100 years ago, there was no chief, at least in the Coast Guard. They were in the Navy, but back in 1920, that was extended out to the Coast Guard, and for 100 years, they've been leading at the deck plate level, doing the right thing, and running the Coast Guard. So we're happy to have John here and stoked to hear his story. His bio: born and raised in Los Angeles, California, raised in Newport Beach, joined the Coast Guard back in August of 1985 with Lima Recruit Company Lima 121, went to recruit training in Cape May. In 1989, he transitioned to the reserves. Throughout his 30-year career, he retired back in 2015 after 30 years as a senior chief bosun mate. Throughout that career, his assignments include a branch chief, waterside security for Port Security Unit 305 out of Fort Eustis, enlisted advisor to the deputy commandant for personnel, that's CG-131 Reserve Affairs at Coast Guard headquarters, National Reserve Recruiting Supervisor, Coast Guard Recruiting Command out of Arlington, Virginia, coxswain at Port Security Unit 311 out of Long Beach back home, And did some tours of duty in 2001 to Operation Southern Watch, Enduring Freedom, and in 2003 during Operation Iraqi Freedom in Umm Qasr, Iraq. Shipboard quartermaster on the Coast Guard Cutter Diligence out of Port Canaveral, Florida, and was also aboard the Coast Guard Cutter Escape out of Charleston, South Carolina. Now, I mean, impressive record of service, right? Now let's talk about his other record of service for all the nonprofits that he's involved in and just military-related organizations. So in addition to the Coast Guard Chief Petty Officers Association, he is also the executive director of the Non-Commissioned Officers Association, serves as chairman to the Foreign Joint Services Non-Commissioned Officer Association, board member for the Joint Leadership Council in the Commonwealth of Virginia, a board member for the AAFES Exchange Retiree Advisory Council, national president-elect, we already went over the Chief Petty Officers Association, chairman of the Defense Health Agency Uniform, Beneficiary Advisory Council, and has previously served as the president of the Coast Guard CPOA out of D.C., as a United States representative to the Foreign Joint Services NCO Association in D.C., and chairman of the membership committee for the CPOA, and I also with the Fleet Reserve Association. John, somebody to look up to, I guess. You know, I mean, you got your hands in everything, man, and a lot of things that really impact military members. So welcome to the show. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Phil and Bill. I'm looking forward to this coming on with you, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing here. I've gone through many of your podcasts, and just great work, and I hope you get many more great people out there in the Coast Guard to come on board and give their story. So looking forward to seeing future podcasts, and thank you for having me.
Awesome. Hey, Bill, before you ask the question, we should preface it with this. John, you got to remember, our whole audience is quarantined right now. These people need to be entertained. So let's entertain them, you know. I'll let Bill ask the question, though.
With Phil's great introduction there, John, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
After watching some of your, or listening to some of your other podcasts, you know, I just had a very, very fun career. You know, 30 years in the Coast Guard for anyone is quite a long adventure. And doing 20 for many, they do their 20 and get out is a great adventure as well. You know, I have to say my most memorable time was with the Port Security Unit and being a reservist. And I spent a lot of time training, you know, Port Security Units, train, and wait for that call. Mm-hmm. And received that call in 2001 and 2003 to deploy over to the Middle East. And I have to say that the deployment in 2003 for Operation Iraqi Freedom was probably the most exciting to gather up the equipment and to go with your unit that you have been training with for so long and get on board the C-5s or the C-17s and flying over to actually do your mission that you've been training for is quite exciting. And I'll tell you, to be a boat coxswain in a port security unit is definitely, I think, the best job out there, to be able to drive those boats and to be able to perform your mission and securing the port or whatever the mission might be. I think we deployed over there about 30 days before the war started on March 21st in 2003, basically over to Kuwait Naval Base to set up camp and set up base and wait for the call. We knew the call was probably going to happen or they wouldn't have sent so many of us over there, along with some of the other port security units. Going over there with our gear, our gas masks, setting up the tents at Kuwait Naval Base, we actually had our tents set up along a wall, a brick wall, where we were told that Saddam had set up the execution of the Kuwaitis back in the previous war, Desert Storm. So our tents, you come out and you look at this wall that's just riddled with holes and just destruction from where they executed people. So seeing that was quite shocking, to see what a human can do to another one. It was just an experience to see that. But eventually we were deployed. The initial part of the war, they sent the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit up to UNKASAR to basically kick ass and take names on day one. While they were doing that, simultaneously as President Bush was giving a speech to the nation, we were actually in our port security unit boats, our PTSBs, heading out from Kuwait Naval Base, and we were escorted by an Army craft. I don't know what kind of ship it was. It was about 180 foot. It was like a buoy tender almost, size-wise. They were escorting us up to the oil platforms. So we were heading up to the oil platforms.
And how many boats were your formation, John?
So that one we had, I think we left with four.
Four, yeah.
Four boats. And it was quite an experience to head up there. The seas weren't too bad, and we were trailing behind this boat in formation, just following up there. They actually, I guess, had sent some other boats up there with some Marines to basically secure the platform. So the Coast Guard, we come in behind. So they already had gone up there, secured these platforms, blew shit up, doors, knocked things down and flipped things over and secured everybody with zip ties. And basically by the time we got there, we basically assumed the watch and then they took off and went to the next place. So
the prize team, you're the prize team,
So after that, it wasn't but a few days later, maybe a week later, they had sent myself and others up to UNKASAR to set up camp up in UNKASAR. The 15th MU went through, and the British were also involved in that UNKASAR. I would say it was probably an eight-hour battle because they walked up there drove in there with a couple of Abrams tanks and basically secured the port within the first 8 hours. But finally, the goal of the beginning initial part of the war was to secure the oil platforms and UNKASAR, because UNKASAR was a deep water port where they were going to be bringing in supplies. They were going to be bringing in aid and food for the Iraqi people. And the other thing was the oil platforms, that's their lifeblood. So that's their economic lifeblood, is that oil. And those platforms are where the oil was pumped out to be put onto the ships to export it. So for the, DOD and everyone, those were the two key things. And to be a part of that and to be there was quite exciting. Shortly after we got into UNKASAR, they were bringing in some minesweepers to sweep. We were intelligence, they claimed there were mines possibly throughout, so they brought in the minesweepers. They brought in dolphin mammals to come through and do their magic. And but before that happened, I'll tell you, the port security units were out there patrolling the rivers. And, I guess you could say we were sweeping ahead of time, making sure that the waterways were clear.
Inadvertently sweeping.
I guess you could say we were the ones out there doing the first mine sweeping, and then they came through and gave the okay.
That was pretty good.
You're like, yeah, it's good. We've been doing this for 2 weeks. I don't know what you're
doing. No big deal. Well, yeah, John, so when you guys were doing that, right? So when you first get there and you become kind of this prize team for the GoPlat or the oil platforms and everything, are you, I'm just thinking, what's going through your mind you're the boat detachment leader, right? At this point?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're your responsibility, right? All four boats that are out there are yours?
Well, they were not all mine. No, I was not in charge. We actually, I was one of the boat coxswains.
Okay, gotcha.
No, was not in charge. Can't claim that one.
Well, either way, let's say, so on your boat, what are you thinking? I mean, it just got serious. You know, this isn't, you're not doing mom and pop boardings.
You're
Iraqi waters. And
you're in a war zone.
Yeah.
You're legitimately at war right now.
So what changes, you know, about your pre-briefs? And I'm just curious how you make that shift, because you've done a lot of time in the Coast Guard. So, and this just turned into a whole different mission set that that a lot of people never get to experience.
Evolution complexity goes up, right?
You know, I'm going to say the same thing that everyone else says. You know, you're just doing your job and you're not really thinking about it. I think the craziest times, you know, you train to put your gas mask on and seal up and you just do it. You do it, you do it. And the only thing I could say were the times when you actually had the Scud missile alarm go off. And what they had done at the time is they placed these Connex boxes and dug them down into the dirt a little bit, not very much. And basically we were told when a Scud missile alarm went off to throw your gear on, full gear, and run into this box and shut the doors. And so I have some photos in my albums of, you know, 20 PSU or 30 PSU personnel in this container sitting there waiting for the all clear alarm. What I can say, you know, is that I was hyperventilating. The very first time that went off, I didn't know if my mask was on right. I didn't know, you know, I was feeling like it was leaking. I was hyperventilating. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to die. You know, it's 103 degrees outside and you're all dressed up. And so your nerves do intensify a little bit. Absolutely. But when it comes to the mission and getting on the TPSBs and heading out, you're just doing your job. You know, you're putting your gear on, your flak jacket and all the ammo and the grenades and everything that you have, and you're just doing your job and you don't think about it. The briefs, you know, they tell you the different freaks that we're going to be on, and they you know, chart out our courses and where we're going to head and how we're going to get there and who's in charge. And, you know, you're doing your job.
Hey, one word, John, one word really keyed my interest. Do you know what it was that you just said?
What?
Bill, do you have any idea?
I'm going to go with grenades.
Boom. You got it, man.
My ears might've perked up a little bit too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know,
maybe the only Coast Guardsman I know who's ever used grenades in a sentence like that.
Were they ASW grenade, like anti-swimmer grenades, or were they the real thing?
They were concussion grenades with timers on them.
Yep.
And
it's
I'll
still
tell
a
you,
grenade, man.
Yeah, the grenade's a grenade.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And let me tell you, when we were practicing with those off of San Clemente Island out in California, off of Pendleton, we all went out there with these grenades, and I was one of the, I think I might have been the first boat in line to actually drop the first grenade for the PSU. I don't know. I don't want to claim that here on recording.
We'll claim it for you. You were first.
I don't know. But
you're the first to tell us about it.
Yeah. As the coxswain, you know, you're sitting there on the boat and you have a specific course. And this is just for practice, right? None of these guys have done it before. And, you know, you're yelling, pull pin, twist, pull, twist. And, you know, you're giving out all the commands as the coxswain. And they're right down there beside you with the grenade. And you're praying to God that they're doing everything you're saying.
Right.
And, you know, they're holding it and their hands are shaking a little bit. And they're waiting to drop it. And you're, as a coxswain, you're praying to God that the timer's right and the spoon is right and everything's right. And it's not going to blow as it's passing by your outboard engine. So, you know what? I know I was the first because I remember
evolution stopped after that.
You will know. Better yet, after the grenade was finally deployed, and we do, I think we might have done three or four in a row. So they're about 10 or 15 seconds apart as we're running down at probably 5 knots at best. And so 5 knots, dropped a grenade. First one blows, water comes up, you know, and the next thing you know, after the last grenade, we all look back and all the fish were just floating up.
Just floating.
Yeah. Fish are floating and here come the seagulls. You know,
right.
It's chow time. And the next boat's behind us, ready to go down the range, the same thing. And so here are the seagulls in front of them, and grenades are going off. And I'm not sure if any seagulls lost their lives, but I know a lot of fish did.
A lot of fish did.
Man. Yeah. And then after that first run, you know, the fish split. So no fish float, you know, after the first run.
That's awesome. Right. Well, so when you're – tell people, too, I don't know how many people were even aware of TPSBs of the early 2000s. I mean, because they've changed now, right? So we've got a whole new design out there that's
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, back – the original ones were 27-foot TPSBs, and they were very heavy. They were underpowered. And those were the first ones that probably came out of the conceptual units, you know, the ones out of Cleveland or Buffalo, and what were the other ones up in the Northeast. So they were heavy. They didn't turn well. And, you know, I don't know what you could outrun, if anything, or get to anywhere. So they were all, you were exposed to the weather, you're exposed to the rain, there was no protection, there wasn't heat, there wasn't all this fancy stuff. They then finally came out after the new units were all commissioned. Our boat chiefs and everyone huddled together somewhere and had a meeting and helped design the new 25-foot TPSBs. That's what the units that deployed over for in 2001 and 2003 had the newer boats. Mm-hmm. A little more power, a little lighter, but you were still exposed to the weather. And you didn't have, you know, cushioned seats with springs in them and all this electronic stuff.
So what you're saying is we're getting soft now. That's really, know, what you're trying to say, John.
You know, part of my, yeah, you're right. And part of my complaint is we had enough problem with the TPSB. If an outboard went, all you call up the engineers, the snipes, they come running down with a new engine, slap a new outboard on, take the old one back and find out what the hell's wrong.
Right.
With these newer boats, like in 305, when I was there in 2013, 14, 15, God, those new boats, there's so many things that can go wrong.
You actually need an engineer and probably a network system specialist.
They're just, I think that's too much, you know, with the seats and the shocks in the seats and all this stuff. I don't understand, but I will say that many of the coxswains from my era on the older TPSBs, we all have VA claims.
Yeah.
Because we all have things that have gone wrong.
Right.
Everybody's got a bad lower back, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's the bosun mate injury.
But, you know, even at 305, you know, you had boats that were down for just crazy reasons. And I just feel like the older boats were much faster to be repaired and be put back online. Because when a boat over in Iraq comes offline, now you're putting a strain on everyone to, you're using boats, they're not getting their maintenance done, their intervals that have to be, you know, taking place because boats are down.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't know. I feel like it's a little too much technology in these boats and too many creature comforts. I mean, now they have like heaters in them and windshield wiper blades. I thought
you were going to say armor. Now they've got they've got armor integrated. We didn't have armor over in Iraq.
Well, they do. Absolutely. Yeah. We didn't have armor. You know, and like I said, we were the first minesweepers out in
right.
Iraq.
So. I don't think the armor that they have now would have helped with mines anyway.
No,
probably not. I know. What about armament on those things when you guys were over there, John?
So we had the 50 cal on front, and then we had we didn't have the 240 Gulf at the time, so we had the old 60s on the rear.
You're hardcore, nice. Man. That's a hardcore armament. Did you ever shoot the 50 and then try to like level the boat out with the 60?
No.
It's fun. Oh. One day.
No, and you know, we also had Mark 19?
Mark 19, the grenade launcher.
Yeah. So, yep. When we first commissioned the units, that was a big thing, and we actually had some of them. Well, I shouldn't say that. From what I understood, somebody had made a couple mistakes with them at another unit, and then they like pulled it, and they said, there's no way in hell we're going to put one of these on the TPSBs. You know, they're going to end up blowing themselves up. So, you know, we didn't actually get to thump those out, but we were getting close. We were praying we could get them. We all wanted them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like shooting the what's on the underneath the mark, the M16.
Oh, like the 203? The 203.
203. You know, those are a blast. Yeah. Those are a blast. So after shooting those and having some of those in the unit, we were really looking forward to the Mark 19, but it didn't happen. So, and I don't think it ever will.
Somebody killed a bunch of fish and probably killed some birds too. Yeah.
But they didn't take our grenades away.
All right. Good.
Right.
Well, so in a typical reserve deployment, right? Let's say like a more peacetime one to maybe Guantanamo Bay or something. I've seen kind of the attitude is you got some people really excited, some people not so excited. For your mission going to Iraq, it's a little different. I mean, you guys had almost like a higher calling, right? At that point, just your nation needed you to go out and fight this enemy.
You felt for the Guantanamo guys. You know, I was in Guantanamo back in 86 when they put things in the beer to keep it from rotting and so forth, which I didn't know.
It's not much nicer now. I've been there recently.
Yeah.
And I think that's called formaldehyde. I'm pretty sure
it was. Yeah. A little bit of formaldehyde, but hey, you know what? When you hadn't had a beer for a while, you didn't care.
Yeah.
So. But, you know, you feel for the guys that were in Guantanamo doing that mission because I was, you know, having been there for refresher training on the 210 and the 213, it's not a fun place to be for even 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So can't imagine being there for 6 months. But I, from what I understand, you know, it's been improved drastically. So, but yeah, doing the actual mission and even going to Korea, I think I went to Korea 3 times for exercises, and just the anticipation and the buildup and getting all the equipment together. And it's so much work to just do a 2-week exercise. You know, that was our drill for the summers to head over to Korea, and PSU 311. That was like our AOR was the Pacific Rim over there.
Okay.
So, you know, even doing that for 2 weeks was exciting and fun, and going over there and setting up tents, and you know, you do a lot of work for such a small little, you know, mission where you're actually on the boat practicing what you're supposed to be doing and training maybe for 7-8 days, and then you're backpacking everything, you know, packing all the equipment up and getting it back on the planes and heading over. Just a little sidebar note, we were over there for a mission. I think we were in Pohang. Yeah, Pohang.
Did they make you guys stay in tents over there?
They did, yeah.
That's absolutely. Just a PSU thing, huh? You don't know, no per diem at the PSU.
No.
I was going to say, I'm hearing a lot about sleeping in tents. Like, I don't know, I joined the Coast Guard for, you know, Iraq, so I didn't have to sleep in a tent. I would have joined the Army if I wanted to sleep in a tent.
Bill's from that softer generation. That's what it is.
I'm older than you, Phil.
I know you are. It's crazy.
So just a little sidebar. We were over there in Pohang, and at the time we had just arrived, and let me tell you what, we set up the tents, or actually I think possibly the Army set our tents up ahead of time. We didn't set our own tents up. But we had a tent city there that was Coast Guard. I think maybe we had 10 or 12 of them. Raining, muddy. We had to put, you know, 2x6s down to walk on and to get around this little tent city. Well, it turns out that the rain was the precursor to the typhoon.
Oh, good.
And, you know, we just arrived, and I would think, you know, if we knew the track of the storm ahead of time, we may not have participated in the exercise, but we did, and it showed up, and it was down south heading our way. And at the time, they had also brought the mammal team in. So we, right next to the TPSBs that were tied up on the pier, were pins for the dolphins. And they were out there doing their training. And I remember one morning heading out to the TPSB, and, you know, you walk by the dolphin pens or you talk to the trainers, and they don't want you to get involved or anything because these are million-dollar mammals, you know. And one of the dolphins didn't come home because, you know, they take them out to run them around and exercise, but apparently this dolphin headed out to the bay and didn't come back. And he's probably out getting his, you know, his nookie out there, who knows. But he eventually came back. Typhoon headed our way, and guess what? The first thing out of there, they packed those dolphins up and flew them on a C-5 out of there to Guam.
Yeah.
You knew they were gone within hours. You knew what, yeah, what they put value on at that point, right?
Yeah, and, you know, 45 minutes before the storm hits, you know, they get the PSU out of there.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, so we spent a little time in Guam and then headed home and canceled the rest of the exercise, of course. But
John, totally unrelated to the Coast Guard, how did the trainers talk to the dolphins?
You know, I don't know.
No,
you think they were going, hey.
Yeah, yeah, like flipper, no, right? No. Like, who knows?
They had whistles. You know, they had like these dog whistles or something. I don't know. They were waving their hands.
I was just curious, man. Yeah. You never know. Yeah. The things you learn, the things you see in the Coast Guard, right?
Yeah, well, you know, these dolphins look like flipper, right? And I don't know what species that is, bottlenose or whatever they are. But the dolphins in Korea, being out on the TPSBs and seeing them, are like half their size and a different color. And I'm thinking, wow, they must, you know, these must be like Asian dolphins. And they had something for them.
We're camouflaging them with the local yeah, fauna, right?
Right.
That's crazy.
These Korean dolphins are like, hey, big boy.
Well, so back in Iraq, what did a normal day kind of look like to you guys?
Was there a normal day?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, what's funny? One thing, Tim Montowski, we had him on. I can't remember what PSU he's with, but the Army set his tents up too when they went down to Haiti. And it's funny, they put him at like the lower end of a stream where the cholera drained down, and then you guys are next to the firing squad wall. It seems to be a habit almost.
No, when we went up to Unkasar, we kind of settled in there, and they had secured the entire facilities, the port facilities, and the British were in there as well. So the British, they know how to do things. I'll tell you what, they come in with.
There was rum. I know there was rum if the British were there.
Yeah, the British came in, and when we first arrived, you know, not much was there. There were some tents in the parking lot, and that's where we were going to set up. The British had secured a warehouse right next to us, and they set up tents in the warehouse. So they were completely, you know,
protected from the elements.
Protected, right. And their tents were beautiful, and
ACs so on the windows.
Yeah. And so we sent our FSs at the time. Now, what are they, SSs?
CSs,
yeah. The FSs at the time in with the British to cook up the beans and the tomatoes and the British breakfast every morning. So you would wake up from your tents and walk in and see all the Brits in there, you know, all chipper and ready to go. And, you know, here we are dragging our asses in to get our grub in the morning. So they set up these Connex boxes, and they basically bring a bakery. So they're baking fresh bread every morning. You're waking up smelling fresh bread and you're, the yeast. Cool. Yeah. And in the evenings, you know, if you make friends with them, they have beer. They actually have beer, and they bring it over in these boxes. So they're setting up these complete bakery units, and they have the best facilities, you know. What do they do for us? They set up these latrines, they dig these dirt trenches, and here we are shitting in the ground and using these dirt holes the first week or so, you know. Here's toilet paper hanging on an M16, you know. So that was the first week or two. Eventually, over time, you know, we had better facilities, and porta-potties came in and blah, 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 and all that stuff, but what was an average day like? You know, you wake up smelling of bread, you eat your meal, you get your brief, you head out in the river and do your patrolling. I do have one story for you, another one. In the river, you know, these outboard engines, you can't hear crap on them, right? So you're out there patrolling and you can't hear. So one of the things I like to do is I would take the boat upriver and turn the engines off and just let the river at 2.5 knots or whatever at the time drift down so you can hear.
Yeah, because right? they were all two-stroke engines, right, on those
yeah.
things?
Yeah, yeah. So you can't hear anything. You can barely hear the guy on the front of the boat talking to you.
Right.
And as a coxswain, the engines are right over your shoulder. And so I would turn them off and float down, and it was just quiet. I mean, you can hear the shoreline if anyone was out there or whatever. So one evening, I don't remember the time, but I would say it was after 2200. All of a sudden, we start hearing some breathing. And, you know, the whole time we're hearing, this is towards the beginning of the war, and we're hearing, you know, divers and swimmers, and we don't know what's happening. So we hear this breathing. And so I'm getting my crew ready. I'm like, hey, get the spotlight. You know, we're drifting closer. I'm going to have to turn the engines on to find out what's going on. We turn the engines on. We turn them off. We're listening. Do you still hear it? Yeah, we still hear it.
What's it sound like? What's it sound like, John?
It's breathing.
Yeah, but
it's
can you do it? Can you mimic it?
Just come on here. You know,
I'm just
breathing.
Curious, man. Like,
Phil's messing all right. with you right
yeah,
now.
No, I was on. Just like, is it come like on. An evil breathing? Like,
we know, thought it was somebody in the water swimming.
Yeah.
We thought it was someone swimming in the water towards the port.
Right.
Okay.
So we're getting closer. We turn the engines on. We get a little closer. And they're like, let's spot it. I'm like, no, don't light it up yet. Don't light it up. We need to be closer. We need to get the boat closer and find out what it is. And my 60 guy's on. He's, you know, trained over where the sound's coming from. I have the other guy on the front of the boat with the spotlight. And we're trying to get closer. We hear the breathing. Turn the engines off. Get closer. Eventually, I'm like, okay, light it up. So the guy turns it on. He lights it up. And what does he see? It's a dog.
Of course.
It's a dog. Yeah. It's a dog in the water. And, you know, yeah.
And that's how the PSU got a mascot.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was all excited. Let me tell you, we were all excited. We're like, this could be it. We could hit the news or something.
You yeah, know? Right. You know? Like, this was it.
Yeah. And
did you get the dog out?
You know, that's the part. My crew was begging me to save the dog. Now, this river is not that big.
Right.
And the dog's trying to swim to shore. And for the sake, you know, I didn't want a crew member to be bit
right.
or take somebody out. So we struggled. I didn't struggle with it, but they were asking me, you know, we need to save this dog. And at the end of the day, we let the dog just keep going. So.
And he made it. We'll just say he made it. Yeah, he made it.
Fine.
He made it.
I believe he made it.
There we go.
He was okay. So. But, you know, what the worst scenario there is somebody gets injured, bit, the dog, you know, whatever, and now I have to go back and explain to the chief
right.
that I made the wrong call.
Yeah, like, so, what the hell are you doing out there? We're at war. Why are you recovering dogs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
Yeah, it's not a SAR case.
Right. That's good. Well, John, let's talk about Chiefly Matters. I mean, you're the president of the Chief Petty Officers Association. So before we get into the organization, let's talk about chiefs in general. You know, when somebody asks you, what is a chief or what do they mean? Why are they special? What would be your reply?
You know what? I almost feel like when you become a chief, like all of a sudden, wisdom shows up. I don't know. Like all of a sudden you
in a book that's chained to your pocket? Is
that... Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, all of a sudden you feel people talk to you differently. You know, you show up in the PERSRU or whatever and you have an issue and everybody talks to you differently and you kind of get things done. I really feel that anchor, you know, you've obviously made it through E6 and you have the wisdom of your rating. And as an E7, you basically should know your rate inside and out, you would think. Mm-hmm. And so now you're tasked with leading and being the person that can find the answers. You may not have the answer, but you don't tell anyone that, right?
For sure.
You go into the chief's mess or you go find the answer if you don't already have it. So, you know, I really feel that the chiefs are a special group in the Coast Guard because we work together and we figure out the answers. And, you know, when something needs to be done, they just tell the chiefs to do it and we get it done, whatever it is. So to be in that position, to lead and to use your experience as a junior enlisted person, watching hopefully good chiefs ahead of you, that when it's your turn and you put that anchor on, you know, you're ready to rock and roll and take charge and get things done. And, you know, there's good chiefs and there's bad chiefs. You know, I'm sure everyone's seen a chief that, you know, tries to take votes and find out what everybody thinks and what they want to do. And in my opinion, a chief needs to just take charge. Whether you're right or wrong, you take charge and you get the job done. At the end of the day, it's about accomplishing the mission. Maybe not necessarily how you got there, but you got it done.
Awesome answer. I've heard Paul Kingsbury, the Navy's Fleet Master Chief, he called chiefs the distinct group of naval elders. What do you think of that?
Great.
Pretty spot on. Yeah. I like it. that's funny. The one relationship I think that a lot of people kind of struggle to understand too is how chiefs who have this, like, you know, this career full of organizational knowledge and experience interact with the officer corps, particularly like junior officers in development. Could you speak to that a little bit? Because it's definitely unique to the scene. We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines. Lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com. E-services.
Yeah, and you know, I find it... I love officers who are prior enlisted. Mm-hmm. I just do. And I think we all do. We just have a tendency to respect them in most cases more, and they can say they've been there, done that, you know. But in the reserves, you find a lot of these officers are coming in through the reserve officer program. And it's basically, I think, 3 weeks, 21 days of, you know, here's the Coast Guard. And so you come in after 21 days of this indoctrination back in New London, and then you're thrown into a unit, and especially, in my opinion, the port security units, which are unique, I think, in the Coast Guard.
Because they eat their young.
Yeah. and here they are, these junior officers coming into the port security units, and they really do look to the chiefs, and they're kind of told, I'm sure, through their training to utilize your chief and to learn from your chief. And so it is nice that they come in wanting to rely on the chief to help them and to help navigate their path, because they're green, they're new, and they don't know a lot about the Coast Guard. And so it's a big deal, I think, in the reserves to have the chiefs mentor and to work with the junior officers, absolutely.
Sure. What's your favorite chief, like, slogan or tagline you know, like you got like knock then enter, you got speak truth to power. What's your favorite?
You know, yeah. Unfortunately, I never, when enlisted in 85, I was junior enlisted through my whole active duty, you know, tour.
Right.
For the first 4 years. So I always had to knock and enter the chief's mess, you know, and I feared the chiefs. I'll tell you what. And back in those days, when I joined and enlisted, they had beards. You know, that was the end.
Really?
Of
the E7s could grow beards?
Yeah. And, oh. And it ended. It ended right. Shortly after.
Man. So, with quarantine right now, half of them do again.
Yeah, it's just under the mask.
You
know,
you walk into the chief's mess and the chief's got a beard. And, you know, back then smoking was much more prevalent. And, you feared them, man. You feared these guys and the tattoos and the warrant officers, even the chief warrant officers, man, the beards, you know, you're like, damn.
We need to bring that back.
Yeah, that's where did that idea. Day go?
That's the best idea I've heard all day.
That's better than khakis, you know, like khakis are cool, but khakis aren't as cool as a beard.
I don't know. I think khakis, beards, and pipe smoking, if we bring all three of those
all
back.
Of them, yep.
So I never was able to enjoy being in the chief's mess and having people knock on the door and enter in my presence, you
right.
know.
Right.
So I was only always on the other side of that door until the reserves becoming a chief. And even, you know, we had the chief's mess at the PSUs, our own little room, you know. So I guess I sidetracked from your question to remember what you asked. What were we talking about?
I lost it. You've now captured me. My interest with what does the chief's mess at the PSU look like? Is it just full of like rum? Is that just rum lining the wall?
You know what? We're so busy on a drill weekend doing things and trying to solve problems from pay issues to, you know, so-and-so, didn't show up to drill.
Yep.
You know, the chiefs are trying to figure out what the hell's going on, right? So when you walk into the chief's mess at a PSU, it's practically empty. You're lucky if there's one chief in there. So it's not the same. It's not like on the ship when you walk in the chief's mess on the ship, everyone's in there except maybe the engineer who's trying to fix the 50-year-old boat.
Right. You know?
So it's different. The chief's mess in a PSU is it's scattered. You know, you're all over the place for 2 days, and it's not quite the same as active duty.
Sure.
So.
You totally could have. You could have went any direction you wanted with that question too. You could have been like, "Yep, it's just Jim. It's Jim Beam." And,
I
you know,
could have. But unfortunately, that happened.
Yep, all have beards wearing khakis.
Really, the chief's mess on the weekend when you're talking about rum and beer, that happens on usually Saturday evening.
There we go. Before you guys go back to the real world.
Yeah. Saturday evening at the bar. The bar is really the chief's mess.
It's good.
Yeah.
Well, so John, tell us about the Chief Petty Officers Association. So I know it's also unique because the Navy does things a little differently, where it's kind of by command. They have their own Chief Petty Officers Association. So each small group has it. We have a national one with the Coast Guard. Could you speak to it?
I can, and the real work of the CPOA is done at the chapter level. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously. Each chapter is unique, and depending on who transferred, what chiefs transferred where, and what their perception is of CPOA, a lot of the chiefs don't necessarily get involved with the CPOA. Some of them, just stick to doing their job and looking for the retirement, But then we have many, many chiefs out there that come into these chapters nearly 60 CPOA chapters all scattered around, even over in Bahrain. They actually want to do something. They actually want to serve. And it's also a place where you can do things outside of the Coast Guard. You know, the Coast Guard is so restrictive on the things that you can do for fundraising or, you can't have money. Necessarily in the chief's mess, but you can have money at a CPOA chapter,
mm-hmm.
and you can raise money. The biggest thing that we do at the headquarters level is to make sure that we are facilitating and providing guidance and helping the chapters in whatever they want to do. And we also, as you know, in these past few years have been working, partnering with the Coast Guard Foundation to help distribute funds to help Coast Guard families and Coast Guard personnel, whether it be a hurricane disaster. You know, what a lot of people don't realize is that the Coast Guard's out there saving people and rescuing people, but their families have been impacted by this hurricane back home.
Right.
And one of the greatest feelings that I've experienced in CPOA is being able to help the families of the Coast Guard personnel to provide assistance and to be there to help them so that the actual Coasties that are out there doing the mission don't have to worry about their home. They don't have to worry that they have food or that the electric bill's being paid or that there's a generator to help light up their home. And that's where the CPOA chapters come in, because it's not just active duty members in that chapter. You have retirees. Mm-hmm. And the retirees are back there taking care of the active duty that are out on the front lines doing the mission of the Coast Guard. So that to me is just amazing what the retirees and what the chapters can do out there. You know, we set up food banks, right? Many of the chapters during the government shutdown were out there opening up food banks all over the country. Sure. And so
in the what do they call it? the baby pantries, that was a huge hit. I know pretty much nationwide. Yeah. Huge thing.
So the CPOA chapters are really the backbone and the meat and potatoes, you know, of the association. And what we can do at the national level is form partnerships and help provide some means to assist financially. But when it comes down to the food pantries and all of that stuff, that's done at the chapter level. Mm-hmm. And they're doing that on their own. And we as an association get to take the credit for that great work. But really the chapters, they do all the good stuff out there.
Very good. What I know the CPOA too is partnered with a, in terms of lobbying, right? Because there were some instances that came up, like with the government shutdown, that lobbying proved effective, right?
You may have seen, I was out there. This was just shortly after I became the national president and took the office. The government shutdown happened, and I was out there with the Military Coalition, which is a group of about 35 organizations, including the VFW, the Fleet Reserve Association,
the heavy hitters,
all of them, the American Legion, all of them, IAVA is the one of the newer organizations, so they're a part of it as well. Basically, when the shutdown happened, a lot of those associations. You know, the DOD was still getting paid and Coast Guard was kind of sitting out there, kind of forgotten about by some of these associations. So at the time, I teamed up with the Sea Service Family Foundation with Mike Little, and we went up to Capitol Hill and we mustered some Coasties who had the day off or took leave that day, and they came out in their civvies, you know, and joined us on the steps of Capitol Hill, and we basically were pushing for S-21, the Pay Our Coast Guard Act. Mm-hmm. And so we split up into groups, and we had boxes of these papers of S-21 and our support for it, and we basically distributed to every office on the Hill. And it wasn't just S-21, it was HR, 394 or something, which was the House version of the same thing. And we went out there, just stormed that hill that day. We actually did some live Facebook feeds from there. And that brought on, I think it was ABC News asked me to come on board and do an interview about what we were doing with the CPOA and how we were pushing for this bill. Unfortunately, it didn't happen, and the shutdown ended. Thank God. But we're still pushing for it, and the military coalition has a lot of priorities. You know, we're out there trying to deal with the VA concurrent receipt, which you may or may not. You know, when you're in the Coast Guard, you don't think about these things. You don't think about after what happens after retirement, and you don't think about the things that can happen to you when you're in the Coast Guard, especially junior. You don't even think about joining these enlisted association or the CPOA or any of that stuff. And a lot of people don't realize what we do, but we are out there every month. We meet on the first Thursday at the Fleet Reserve Association, and each one person from each association, we all get together and we talk about what we're all doing, what each association is doing on the Hill and the different bills that we're dealing with. And we have committees. So we have a veterans committee and a tax committee and all these different committees, and they meet ahead of time to talk about specific issues in those areas, you know, for the committee. And they're out there, we're up there on the Hill knocking on doors. We're speaking to different congressmen and senators that are in these various committees, trying to get their support for these various bills that are ultimately to help the veterans and the enlisted and active duty reserves, the officers, everybody. MOA is, you know, part of this association, and they're a big, huge player, and they're a powerhouse. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of people and a lot of influence on the Hill. So a lot of times we're partnering and we're signing on to these different letters to the congressmen and these committees to support. So whenever you look at these letters that are sent up to the Hill, you'll see 32 names, and the Chief Petty Officers Association is one of the signers on those letters.
Right, which is one of the, I think that's one of the major, I wouldn't call it selling points, but a major reason to join the association, to pay your dues, to be able to support things like that, that in uniform you wouldn't be able to do, but the organization as a whole can do to support its membership, whether CPOA, CGEA, that's a subsidiary of the Chiefs. And I are, we got a listener, Nick, who's telling us IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
Veterans of America.
There
yeah.
we go. We got thank it. All you. Right. Yeah, thanks, IAVA. Nick.
And that's a great organization. You know, they have meetups all over the country, and basically it's free, and you just show up at a restaurant or a location, and everyone just gets together and talks about issues and problems. And so I really do enjoy that organization as well. It's a good one.
When Sea Service Family Association or organization, how did, so I don't think anybody ever really heard of them. I didn't,
no.
I myself didn't know that the CPOA was involved in, any kind of lobbying effort until it really became a need. But it was pretty cool to see that relationship.
I think we all learned a lot during the shutdown.
Yeah, right? You know, we don't really lobby. I would say we advocate.
A signatory to lobbying documents. Yeah. How about that?
Yeah, so like I think that. A lot of lobbyists would say they advocate as well, John.
Yeah. But, you know, we're not up there trying to knock on, you know, senators' doors saying, hey, we need more cutters.
Right.
You know, we need an icebreaker, or we need better housing at Cape May or whatever.
All true. All those things are true, though.
And they are. And as much as I would love to be able to start that, because that's what I do with NCOA, the Non-Commissioned Officers Association, mm-hmm. is I do go on the Hill and I do fight for things with them because we have a lobby presence. Mm-hmm. With CPOA, we try to stay neutral. We get involved with the coalition. We will sign on to certain letters and things like that help everybody in the military or the, you know, dealing with the VA. When it came to the shutdown and it came to paying the Coast Guard and, hey, did you guys, you know, you forgot about us and we need our paycheck too to survive. You know, our members in the Coast Guard, they can't afford to miss paychecks.
Right.
especially the junior ones who haven't built up any savings or anything.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So when it came to that, you know, there was no choice. We had to go knock on doors and advocate on the Hill. And I'll do it again, and I'll keep pushing for the Para Coast Guard Act. The Commandant, you know, he fired up his team up at headquarters to go out there and to lobby for it. So he did a great job as well. And, you know, honestly, he was probably just weeks away from putting the Coast Guard in with the Navy.
Right.
Oh, really? Wow.
You know, and the purpose of that, it took an executive order from the president to do it. Mm-hmm. But basically what he was doing is basically taking an accounting line item from the Navy and borrowing money. So he was basically saying, hey, we're going to borrow money from the Navy to pay the Coast Guard until this is over. And then the executive order would have put us right back, you know, where we were.
Sure.
But, you know, everybody was freaking out. Oh, once you put us over there, you know, we're going to be, they're going to leave us there with the Navy. And at the end of the day, it was just about getting funds, borrowing some money. And the only way to do that was to kind of go over it, you know, and be a part of the Navy for a little while to pay ourselves and then pop back out and then pay back the money.
Very cool to hear that dynamic, and good to know that the CPOA was, you know, providing a leadership role a little bit in that too.
Absolutely.
To make that happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, it's nice, you know, not all the CPOA national presidents live here in DC area. You know, I'm in Arlington, right across the river. So it's nice to have our headquarters here in Springfield, Virginia, which is in the Beltway. And I live here. So our executive director, Randy Reed, you know, he's working every single day at the CPOA national office there in Springfield. And he does a lot of the work, and it's nice to be here with him.
Right.
So that I can participate. I can join the military coalition meetings as well. So when I show up there, I have two hats. I'm the president of CPOA and I'm the legislative director at NCOA. So when we go there, Randy attends the meetings as well as the executive director, and I wear my NCOA hat, not my CPOA hat.
Right.
You're a good man. You're a good man to know, John.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, I think you're just a good man to know.
I think plugged in is the word.
Right, plugged in. You're plugged in and living in the right spot for sure.
Right.
Well, you know, prior to I moved what happened, I was a recruiter out at the Lakewood office in Los Angeles, recruiting specifically port security unit recruits, trying to keep the port security unit filled. I was on ADOS and then EAD orders to recruit out of LA there. And eventually I made chief in the recruiting office, and recruiting command came out to the office to ask one of the chiefs. There were three of us in the office at the time, if he wanted to come back and be the recruiter in charge in DC. And he did not want to move his family to DC. And at the time I heard this in the back room. And so I went up to Lieutenant Commander Solak, who was the person out there asking the question. I said, "Hey, sir, can I go? Can I take the office?" And you know what? A week later, I had orders, and I was on my way to D.C. And at the time, I was the treasurer for the LALB CPOA. And when I moved back here, I know you've both heard of Master Chief Mark Allen.
Yep.
Right? The Reserve Force Master Chief. I came back here, and I got involved with the CPOA D.C. chapter. He was the president of the chapter at the time, and as well, you know, became the Reserve Force Master Chief with Admiral Papp. I just enjoyed being involved, and he kind of sucked me in. And next thing you know, I'm the vice president there of that chapter with Mark, Master Chief Allen. And then the next thing you know, he departs to become the Reserve Force Master Chief, and we need a new president. So the next thing you know, I'm the president of the chapter. He had that chapter just purring. I mean, all engines were going, whether it was fundraising, doing Christmas parties for underprivileged kids in D.C., handing out turkeys, you know, at Thanksgiving, doing the Flags Across America at the Arlington Cemetery, right, putting flags in all the Coast Guard graves. Mm-hmm. And so I inherited all of that. And I remember one day, and this is what really got me pumped up, and one day Admiral Papp came over and the, you know, the Coast Guard monument there on Coast Guard Hill was, you know, what, 40, 50 years old and just falling apart with weather and all the stuff. And I remember going out there and pressure washing it to clean it off for Memorial Day and for Veterans Day so that we can do the Flags Across America event. So he came up to me and he said, hey, you know, Senior Chief, I can't really raise money to fix this, but I would really like to ask and see if the chiefs could maybe do something and raise some money. So we got our chiefs together in the meeting, and the next thing you know, we developed a gold coin for the monument. We were selling it for $20 a piece. I think we ended up raising about $40,000 in coin sales. And then as well, they raffled off a convertible Camaro. We were able to
total
take the
total
money.
Chief ride too.
Yeah.
You know,
and guess a Navy guy won it.
Yeah.
So.
You guys got to learn to fix it better.
We ended up raising a total between the raffle and the money coming in and the various ways, over $100,000.
Awesome.
To repair that monument. So what that did for me is, you know, and I have to give kudos to Senior Chief Grimes, who helped with the coin sales and making that happen. So that was impressive. I didn't know you could sell $40,000 worth of coins.
That's a lot of coin.
Yeah, $20 a piece.
Yeah, for a good cause, though, right? I mean,
oh, for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it might have been more than that, but rough number. At the end of the day, I was so, like, Master Chief Allen just got me pumped up, man. The next thing you know, I'm involved doing the Memorial Day speeches for the Fleet Reservists Association at the Navy Memorial. So I'm running that show because that's what he did.
Right.
So I got thrown into that. Then HUD calls me up for their Veterans Day service that they do out in front of the HUD building with the secretary, and I'm doing that. And so all of a sudden I'm involved with this stuff, and the fleet of the Foreign Joint Service Non-Commissioned Officers Association, you know, I'm involved with that as a Coast Guard rep. And the next thing you know, I'm wrapped up in all this stuff. So I don't know how I got here, because in LA, I was involved as a treasurer. You know, you're counting beans, right?
Right.
Once a month. Yeah, we have $3,000 in the bank, you know. Approve the minutes. And the next thing you know, I moved to D.C. to be the RAC.
That was really good, by the way. That pretty much summed up a meeting right there.
Yeah. The next thing you know, I'm like thrown into the fire in D.C. and the city just grows on you. You know, you want to help. And here I am today advocating and fighting for issues to help veterans and to help, you know, our members. And I love it. I love it. But it is burning me out, though. There will be a day where I have to tone it down a little bit. But I just love this. I love this job. I love all of them.
Awesome. We appreciate,
well, we appreciate
what
you're
doing.
Doing it for sure, Jeff. That's...
I was going to ask you who you thought your best chapter was, but I think we have the answer. I mean, that's it. That's a moot point.
Yeah.
Yeah. NCR wins, right?
Yeah. And you know what? And that's why I say the chapters are really the backbone of this association. So to be the national president is great. You know, taking care of the budget and making sure that everything runs and we have our, you know, our conventions and taking care of business at the national level, but the work really happens at the chapter level. And the magazine has been improved. I don't know if you remember, but about 8 years ago it was black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's color. And we're trying to get more stories. We're trying to get people, the MCPOG and people, to submit stories or articles, or and my goal is, and I talked to Master Chief Vander Hayden and also Master Chief Rob Bushy, what do you want CPUA to do? What can we do to help you? Is it training? Is it, you know, what can we do at CPUA at a national level to help the Coast Guard, help the enlisted? What can we do? And, you know, Senior Chief Bryn Simonetti started that the Mentor Project, mm-hmm. right? So CPUA hosts their website and helps them, and we're trying to bring that Mentor Project into the CPUA. I would like to have a CPUA phone app where you can find resources to the VA, resources for the Coast Guard, you know.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Everybody lives by their phones nowadays.
That'd yeah, and these are, you know, this year we're canceling our convention. It's going to be out in the newsletter tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Our convention will be canceled from Seattle. We're going to be doing it virtually on Zoom or something for a half a day to take care of just business things that we mm-hmm. have to.
John, way to put a damper on the podcast, man. We were at like a high note, and then you just drop that news. You got to save that for later on. That's got to be, that should come out of some other venue.
Okay, there you go.
I know people love the convention, man. It is the,
they do.
It's the centennial anniversary. So it's, I mean, this was poised to be a big one. Are we going to reschedule?
Well, what we're doing is we were planning for, and hopefully the convention committee will approve, Randy, the executive director, and myself have been working to have our next convention up in Grand Haven during Coast Guard Festival.
Yeah. Oh, that'll be
awesome.
Great.
Yeah, that'll be fun. We did a live show there last year, and yeah, what an event.
Yeah.
Yeah, what an event.
Yeah.
You know, Phil, I don't even feel like it's a downer. I feel like 2020 is just canceled, and next year we're just going to start 2020 over again.
Yeah, we'll just restart. 2020 is forgotten.
2020.
Yeah.
Right.
Good.
Yeah. So that's our goal and hope, is to have the convention. We probably shack up in Grand Rapids, which is about a 30-minute drive from Grand Haven. Because if you were there last year, Grand Haven, it's amazing the people that come from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, 90% of those people aren't even Coasties. They just love the Coast Guard.
And Moscow mules.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know,
a story for another day.
Yeah, I went there the year before for the MCPOG anniversary that they had up there, celebrating those, all the Master Chiefs of the Coast Guard. And my wife and I were right on the front street in a hotel, and our windows and our porch and everything faced the street where all of the vendors were with the food, and with the rivers right there, and mm-hmm. the station was off to the left. So the Coast Guard Festival fireworks were taking place Saturday evening, and it was a huge party, right? It goes everything's happening all the time. We go to bed, we wake up the next morning, and it's gone. Everything's gone.
It's gone.
The whole city's cleaned.
Just it's killed left. It.
Right in the middle of the night, Sunday morning, you wake up, the vendors are gone, the Ferris wheel's gone, everything's gone, cleaned up, and we were just in shock. We were like, oh my God, like, it's over.
Michiganders, right? I mean, that's what they call it. Yeah, there's a special breed up there.
That's set up for Midwest work ethic.
Yep.
It's just crazy. But the festival, I really want to bring that to the convention, because a lot of our members have never experienced that, and I know you did. I think it's amazing.
Yeah,
I think it's amazing.
Yeah,
so,
it's a special thing in a special place for sure.
It is. So it's what I'd like to do for the 2021 convention. It's also an election year, so we'll be installing new officers. Maybe I'll be still around. I don't know. So, but
it's either going to be a really cool celebration on a re-election, or a really cool send-off. You know,
whatever
way.
It is.
Yeah, it doesn't matter either way, right? I just have a good time.
We'll just there for the party.
Yeah, we'll just be there for the party. So. That's awesome. Well, John, where can people – so, you know, hopefully all chapters, and I think they are, everybody's reaching out to guys that are making E7 and, you know, hope to one day be welcomed into the Chief Petty Officer fold. But where can everybody, if they haven't heard about you, find out more? Can people donate that are not members? You know, just how can people support CPOA that may not be members?
So we do, they can go to uscgcpoa.org, and on that site they can join. We now have the ability to join online, and you can use a credit card instead of sending a check in, or, you know. The donation piece, most of that, we have donations for the CCAF fund, which is a scholarship fund for Coast Guard dependents, children. So they can donate to that as well. But all of that can be found online. And they can also go on there and find their local chapter. And they can see who their president is. They can email them to get involved if they happen to be in a sector and they're not sure who's running it. You know, they can go online and find that out too.
For sure, uscgcpoa.org. And if any hard chargers are out there, I heard a whole ton of initiatives that need a champion right now. I think CPOA needs an app. I heard that. You're going to need a planning committee for this Grand Haven Ultimate Bash is what I think you guys ought to call it.
Well,
we're called the first anniversary of 2020.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. So at our conventions, we actually have a committee that gets together to decide where the next year's event will be. What Randy and I have done is we've already reached out to Grand Rapids and Grand Haven, and we're basically putting everything together and handing it to the committee so that it's a no-brainer.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
It's got my vote, for what it's worth.
Excellent.
Hey, John, I'm going to ask you one parting question before we end this. So your first unit was the Coast Guard Cutter Escape out of Charleston, South Carolina, right?
The Coast Guard Cutter Diligence, Port Canaveral.
The Diligence. Okay. Tell us that was your introduction to the Coast Guard. What was the first case that you had on the Diligence, or the first time that you know, kind of brought it home like, man, I picked the right job?
do you really want me to tell you the answer to this?
Yeah, we want to hear it. Let's hear it.
You're not going to believe it. I show up there around Thanksgiving, and this was 1985, and we actually came back from patrol. I think we were out for Christmas. We came back from patrol, just your standard Haitian ops, you know, LE, drug interdiction. I can't even remember. That was my first patrol, so I was mess cooking in the wardroom. So I don't even know what happened outside.
Just smelled like bacon grease.
So we come back to port, and we're on trop hours, and you know, the weather down there is in December, January is not that bad. A little chilly, that bad. And next thing, I go from wardroom mess cook to a bosun chair hanging over the side, painting the anchor, you know, cleaning the boat up and needle gunning, green death, red lead, all that stuff that's banned now.
Yeah.
Thank you, VA. So the first thing that happens is I think lunch was getting prepared at 1100. They were getting ready to serve chow. And everybody was getting ready to watch the space shuttle take off.
Oh, man.
And you know where I'm going here.
Yeah, we know where the story's going now. Yeah. Wow.
So here we are in port, not really ready to get underway on a 210. You know, engineers are taking things apart and so forth. And the shuttle goes up. And that was my first shuttle launch that I had ever seen in person. And I'm standing on the forecastle watching it go up. And didn't look right. You know, you've all seen the video. Didn't look right. And I'm just a little old E3, you know, don't have much to do except mess cook and needle gun. Watch that thing happen. It blew up. You can watch it, you know, sparkles coming down. And we all knew something was wrong. I think it took us a few days to get the ship back together. The engines were kind of in pieces, and so the engineers put it all back together, and our job was to go out there on the Diligence and secure the perimeter. So we had small boats, and, you know, immediately small boats were out there, and at the time, 82-footer. But then they wanted the Diligence to be out there to secure the area. So I guess they had put a buoy where they marked the spot where they thought most of the debris in the capsule were, And so we went out there and we had a perimeter, 1 mile. And I was a helmsman at the time on watch when I wasn't, you know, I think I finished mess cooking at that time. But I was a helmsman and we basically just circled, you know, a mile off the buoy, making sure that nobody went inside that zone. So that was really my first exciting big event in the Coast Guard where I was like, wow, you know, we're on the news. This is a big thing. And it was also a tragedy. You know, it was our pride as a nation. And so it really kind of hit hard. And to be on watch and to be actually involved with that crisis was exciting to be in the Coast Guard and to see that. So I would say that was my first real case, you know, that I was a part of.
What a thing. Be your first real case. I mean, that's one of those events that if you were alive when that happened, you remember exactly where you were and what you were doing.
Yeah.
When it happened.
So, yeah. So that was it in a nutshell, but what a time, you know, and I know we've had many more times since then in the Coast Guard where, you know, the excitement being 9/11 when that happened, being in LA and just seeing the sky shut down and the port security unit. We all ran to the base and got on our boats to make sure the port was secure because at the time we didn't really know what was happening. You know, we didn't know what was going on. So we've all experienced at some point in our career some exciting time. Now we have COVID-19, right? This is another memory for a lot of people. So
it's not the apocalypse we wanted, though.
No,
I'm just come on. Somebody had to say it. No, hey John, thank you. Thanks for that story, John. I think that really brings it home.
Sure.
About this is why people join the Coast Guard for that reason right there. And you got it within a couple of weeks of coming in, John. We thank you for your time today. You're a busy man,
absolutely.
And we thank you for your work with all the organizations that you're a part of, and in particular the Coast Guard Chief Petty Officers Association. And, of course, we thank you for your 30 years of service to the country and how you're continuing to serve now.
And finally, she shows up.
There right she is. The you told me she was coming in. Yep.
Yeah. Hey, thank you for what you guys do. And you're doing a great job, too. And just for anyone in the Coast Guard to be able to watch your show.
Thanks, John. We appreciate it. Thank you for your time. And thanks for looking out for us. You
know,
continuing to serve even after retirement. We really appreciate everything that
my pleasure. Doing. It's an honor.
Stay safe, stay healthy, John. Thanks again.
Hey, Bill, Phil, take care. Thank you.
Take care, John.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.